All right. Good morning. I would like to welcome all of you to the U.S. Institute of Peace and to this public event on the volatile situation in Lebanon. I'm Abby Williams, Vice President of the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention here at the Institute. Lebanon, unfortunately, is back in the headlines. And in the wake of the violence in Lebanon over the past week, the most serious since the country's civil war, I think we think it is important to assess the underlying dynamics of the situation there and the current crisis, the prospects for a political settlement to the crisis, and the implications for U.S. foreign policy. We are fortunate this morning to have with us three outstanding panelists who have deep knowledge of Lebanon and broad experience in that country, and also an astute understanding of the dynamics in the broader Middle East region. I will introduce them in the order in which they will make their remarks this morning. Mona Yacoubian directs the Lebanon Working Group here at the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention at the Institute. The working group seeks to deepen understanding of the complexities underlying the crisis in Lebanon, with a particular focus on how to prevent further conflict and establish long-term peace and stability both within Lebanon and on its borders. Mona recently returned from a research trip to Beirut, and she left the evening before hostilities actually broke out, which was, of course, tremendous relief to all of us here at the Institute, and I'm sure to her family as well. Barbara Slavin is a senior fellow at the Institute's Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program, where her project has focused on Iran's influence in three regional conflicts, including Lebanon. She also recently returned from a research trip to Iran and Lebanon, where she focused on Iran's relationship with Hezbollah. Barbara is also senior diplomatic correspondent with USA Today and has a forthcoming USIP special report examining Iran's influence in the Middle East. Emil Hokayam is a research fellow with the Henry L. Stimson Center's Southwest Asia Gulf Program. Emil is an astute analyst of Lebanese and Syrian politics and security. He has written a number of articles on the Middle East, including on Lebanon and Syria. Last November, he testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the challenges posed by Syria to Lebanese security. Each speaker will speak for about 10 minutes, which would leave ample time for the question and answer session. Okay?
Thanks.
So, Mona?
Great. Thanks, Abby. Yeah. Good morning. Thank all of you for coming. I thought what I would do is first maybe give a very brief background to the violence and what happened in the past week, and then offer you very short impressions from my trip, a few analytic bottom lines, and then if time permits, maybe just a couple comments on implications for U.S. policy. In terms of the background to what happened, I would say that essentially three things converged at once to bring Lebanon into the sort of violent throes of conflict that we've witnessed over the past week. First, there were labor strikes that had been long scheduled to take place on May 7th. This is in response to dramatic escalation in prices. The first quarter inflation in Lebanon for 2008 was 10%. And this was something I heard throughout while I was there, just the skyrocketing of gasoline and food prices. Lots of disgruntlement over that. Second was a call by the opposition, Hezbollah and General Aoun together, to take advantage of those labor strikes to also demonstrate against the government. Nothing new in either of those things. Both of those things have happened before. It's the third development, all of which took place again, this last one in the span of about 24 hours, that I think was the primary impetus for the violence, and that was a decision by the Lebanese government, by the cabinet, to do two things. One, to launch an investigation into Hezbollah's telecommunications network. And secondly, to call for the dismissal of the airport chief of security, someone who is allied with Hezbollah. Now, both of these, the telecommunications network is something that has been long understood to exist. There was really nothing new in that. The second was announcements that Hezbollah had surveillance cameras monitoring runways at the Beirut airport, and again questioning the legality and the intent of that monitoring. Again, I would underscore that both of those were things that were previously known. They were not new. But the cabinet, in an historic all-night meeting on, I guess it was Monday night, met and decided to take these two measures on Tuesday. The labor strike on Wednesday quickly deteriorated into violence with burning tires and so forth, blocked roads to the Beirut airport. And then I think on Thursday, May 8th, things really took off when Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, in a speech, blamed the government for the crisis, called the decision to act against Hezbollah's telecommunications network an act of open war, and said that Hezbollah had the right to, quote, cut the hands of anyone who attempts to disarm them. He demanded that these government decisions be rescinded. And it was really moments after this news conference that the fireworks, I think, really began. By Friday, Hezbollah had taken control of West Beirut, but opted to hand back significant portions of whatever they had taken back into the control of the army. While Beirut eventually calmed down, fighting then spread to the northern city of Tripoli, and also to the Shouf Mountains east of Beirut. Tolls right now are that more than 80 were killed and 200 wounded. But of course, things have in the past 2 days calmed down substantially. And I would note a very important development, which is yesterday the Lebanese cabinet decided to rescind those two decisions that were initially taken. It, of course, remains to be seen whether additional measures will be taken to resolve Lebanon's longstanding political stalemate, which, of course, looms behind all of this. In terms of impressions from my trip, despite, I think, nearly universal pessimism when I got there and a palpable sense of tension in the air, no one foresaw the kind of violent escalation in tension that took place. Some did underscore the severity of the charges that had been leveled against Hezbollah, but no one predicted that they would react as vehemently as they did. And I will say that the contrast between this absolutely beautiful sunny afternoon in Beirut on Tuesday and the nightmare that was unleashed essentially the next day was incredibly stark. That said, the pessimism that I describe, very many people told me that the elements are in place for a civil war in Lebanon. They talked about sectarian rearming, particularly amongst the Sunnis, discourse that is deeply polarized, strong enmity and mistrust among sects, which I would argue now has further deepened. And while I was there, sectarian clashes in mixed Sunni-Shiite neighborhoods began again. They had been taking place in January, had stopped for some period of time. They started again while I was there. One interlocutor I met with went so far as to say, when I asked him, does Lebanon have the prospect of sliding into a civil war? He said it is in a civil war. It's a silent civil war, or a cold civil war, but it is in. That said, when people then would always reassure me, well, you know, civil war is not going to happen because it will only take place when external players want it to take place. When Iran and Saudi Arabia and the United States and Syria want there to be civil war in Lebanon, that's when there will be civil war. It won't take place because no one in Lebanon wants civil war, especially Hezbollah. It's not in their interest. It won't take place because Hezbollah will not use its arms against the Lebanese people. This has been a long-standing promise, mantra, repeated by Hezbollah. Well, unfortunately, I think all of these assurances, certainly in the short term, in the very short term of that 1 week, prove false. What happens, I think, in the coming days and weeks remains to be seen. Let me offer four sort of analytic bottom lines that I come away with. First, I think one cannot underestimate Lebanon's inherent volatility. And the tremendous polarization that characterizes the region in which Lebanon is situated, these are significant factors. The potential for miscalculation at the time of this political, long-standing, 18-month-long political impasse, I think, was huge. And I would argue that's precisely what happened. I think it was a major strategic error on the part of the government to take the two decisions that they took. It was a huge provocation. Hezbollah, I think, took it almost as an existential threat, particularly the threat against its telecommunications network, which it views as a vital part of its military infrastructure, and indeed has underscored the critical role that its telecommunications network played in the summer 2006 war with Israel. By the same token, I think Hezbollah made a huge, I would say, miscalculation in its very vehement response. Yes, it was a flexing of muscles. Yes, they have shown the power that they exert. I do think a Rubicon of sorts was crossed in turning its arms on other Lebanese, a promise that it has always said it would keep. So huge red lines crossed on both sides, and I think this leaves Lebanon in a more volatile and even more dangerous place. Second, though, I want to underscore, because I think if we look in the press reports and on the opinion pages and elsewhere, the role of external players, I believe, while important in Lebanon, is being exaggerated. And I think it's being exaggerated to Lebanon's peril. Again, I think the Lebanese themselves evince this kind of, I would almost say, strange detachment from what's going on in their country. As I said, many people would say, well, we're not going to have a civil war, as I said, because external players don't want it. Basically, it's out of our hands. I think that the Iran threat has been exaggerated by Lebanese, by our government. And again, I think that this works to Lebanon's disadvantage. At the same time, Hezbollah, I would say, vastly exaggerates the role of the United States and Israel and so forth. Hassan Nasrallah claimed that the Lebanese government wants to turn the airport into, quote, a base for the FBI, CIA, and Mossad. So again, I think conspiracy theorists abound in Lebanon, to its detriment. While external players have an important role to play in Lebanon's turmoil, and I do not believe that lasting peace in Lebanon will be achieved without broader regional stability, I do think it is essential to understand the internal context and conditions that exist in Lebanon and that, frankly, make it ripe for external meddling. That brings me to my third point, which is that I think the current conflict that we're witnessing in Lebanon is largely about internal dynamics. Namely, I think we are witnessing the need within Lebanon to redefine the distribution of power. Lebanon's reality continues to evolve and change. The Lebanon of today is most certainly not the Lebanon of 1943, when the National Pact was agreed upon. Arguably, I don't know, it is not reflective of the Lebanon of the 1990 Ta'if Agreement that helped bring an end to the 15-year civil war. Again, I think one can talk about this. I think Lebanon was born with an identity crisis and continues to struggle with it. I think that the current crisis, I would trace its immediate roots to the withdrawal of the Syrian military in 2005. Which itself came on the heels of the withdrawal of the Israeli army in 2000, and I think created the conditions for the current renegotiating of the rules of the game that is going on in Lebanon today. I believe that that's what we're witnessing, and I think it can be solved either through violence or through negotiation. Finally, regarding the prospects for civil war in Lebanon, I would say that the next several days and weeks are critical. It's very important to note that the army maintained its cohesion throughout this, which I think is huge and an incredibly positive development to note. It will be essential, of course, that continues and that it continues to play a role of sort of neutral arbiter, if that's possible. I think what will be critical is whether having now stood back from the two sort of orders that put Hezbollah out into the streets, can all the parties to the Lebanese conflict move forward with dialogue and trying to seek political consensus in Lebanon? The Arab League is trying to mediate that so far, I think, with very little success. Have the Lebanese looked over the brink and decided that they don't want to go there? And are they willing to make the necessary political compromises that all sides have to make in order to ensure lasting peace and stability? Abby, do I have time for two quick points on U.S. policy?
Two very quick points.
I just think the United States needs to dramatically reorient its policy toward Lebanon and, frankly, toward the region. I think that the role to date has been one of, unfortunately, I would say, exacerbating tensions rather than seeking to help mediate political solution to the conflict. The extent to which the U.S. government overemphasizes Iran's role, I think, contributes to the very dangerous polarization that's going on not only in Lebanon but within the region. Obviously, I guess the broader policy recommendations would be, as I say, a reorientation of policy in Lebanon and toward one that seeks consensus and reconciliation among the Lebanese. And secondly, I believe it's essential to begin talking about opening dialogue and talks with broader regional players, namely Iran and Syria. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mona. I'll turn the microphone over to Barbara.
Well, I'm in the great position of agreeing with pretty much everything Mona has said. I went to Iran in March and then went to Beirut following that, which was a very interesting way to do it. And I'm not by any means a Lebanon expert. It was my first extended time in Lebanon, so I really defer to Mona and to Emil in terms of deep understanding of Lebanon. But I think what is interesting and important to point out is some reflections on the Hezbollah-Iran connection and how that has evolved over time. I was told repeatedly in both Iran and Lebanon that Hezbollah and Iran are partners now, that it's much more of an alliance than it is a patron-client relationship or a boss-proxy relationship. Obviously, when Hezbollah was created in the 1980s, it was built on a Lebanese base, but it was entirely an Iranian creation in many ways. The Revolutionary Guard sent 1,500 people to Lebanon in the early 1980s, and they put together Hezbollah. And Hezbollah has been very dependent on Iran in terms of ideology and certainly remains dependent in many ways for arms and for money. But the power relationship has changed, and many Iranians told me that they regard Hezbollah as a more successful exemplar of the Islamic Revolution than Iran is. There's more admiration in Iran for Nasrallah than there is for their own supreme leader. And the dynamics of the relationship between the two began to change very much in the 90s when Iran cut back funding in the early 90s to focus on its own reconstruction after the Iran-Iraq War. And Hezbollah began to enter the Lebanese political scene in a major way. This dynamic continued when Hatemi was president of Iran. He tried to focus on ties with the Lebanese government as a whole rather than exclusively focusing on Hezbollah. And after 2000, after the Israelis withdrew unilaterally from southern Lebanon, of course this was an enormous feather in Nasrallah's cap, and this whole charismatic image of Nasrallah as being something more than an Iranian stooge, as being something more than a Shia, but being an Arab champion, began to grow at that time. And of course this image was replenished after 2006 when Nasrallah again was seen as having bested the Israelis. So it's a complicated relationship. I made some calls after the fighting broke out last week, and again both Iranian and Lebanese sources told me that it was the decision of Hassan Nasrallah to respond in a military fashion to what was regarded as provocations from the senior government, that he did not ask permission in advance from Tehran to defend what are regarded as very important assets for Hezbollah, namely, in particular, this telecommunications network in the south. So this was not something that was cooked up in Tehran. was something that was decided by Hezbollah. That said, I think we also should be careful to make some distinctions between Hezbollah and Hamas. There were a number of comments after Hezbollah moved into West Beirut that this was Gaza too, that this was somehow akin to the takeover of Gaza by Hamas in 2007. And there are many differences between these groups, and there are many differences, obviously, in their relationships with Iran. Hezbollah is, as I mentioned, the proudest accomplishment, export of the Iranian revolution. It's a group that Iran is extremely proud of, that has a very special relationship with. The Iranian relationship with Hamas is much more opportunistic and short-lived. It really only began in 2006 after Hamas won legislative elections, and a decision was made by Saudi Arabia, the other Gulf Arab states, to cut off funding to Hamas at that time. And so Hamas was left in a situation where it really had nowhere else to turn but Tehran. And of course, Iran was happy to step in once again to prove its pro-Arab bona fides by supporting Hamas. But it's a very different relationship than the one that it has with Hezbollah. Also, Hezbollah went into West Beirut, but then turned over the areas to the Lebanese army. So one can say that it showed its ability to occupy at least briefly West Beirut, but it did not remain in the same way that Hamas has remained in control of Gaza. So I think this is a false analogy. Looking at it from Iran's perspective, Iran is both proud and concerned about the events in Lebanon. They're proud that Hezbollah appears to have won this battle in a long-standing war to increase the power of the Shia within Lebanon. But Iran is also concerned. Iran has not been seeking another civil war in Lebanon. Iran does not want to exacerbate Sunni-Shia tensions in the region, which are already at such a high pitch because of the situation in Iraq. Again, this detracts from Iran's ability to project itself as something more than a Persian Shia phenomenon. They want to show that they have pan-Arab, pan-Islamic legitimate concerns, that they represent the downtrodden in the Arab world, not only in the Shia, but more broadly. And so a Sunni-Shia civil war in Lebanon does not serve their interests. They're also very worried about their situation in terms of being isolated over their nuclear program and over the situation in Iraq. There was a very interesting editorial in a Lebanese, rather an Iranian newspaper yesterday. It's a paper that's close to former President Rafsanjani. It's called Kargozaran, or Construction. And it warns that a civil war in Lebanon will unleash Sunni fundamentalist terrorists. And I think we have seen that it has weakened, certainly the Sunni government. It's weakened the Hariri faction because they did not prevail in this contest against Hezbollah. And there are a lot of Sunni fundamentalist crazies who are willing to take up the battle against Hezbollah. And this editorial also warned that the United States would use the fighting in Lebanon to build its case against Iran, to pressure the Europeans to impose more sanctions against Iran. And indeed, President Bush today, speaking to the Israeli Knesset, conflated once again Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Hezbollah, three extremely different organizations, and blamed the activities of all three on Iran. I cannot think of a more damaging analysis if you actually want to try to reduce tension in the region than to conflate these three groups and to put the onus completely on Tehran. There's a lot of talk now that the U.S. is preparing some sort of military strike against Iran because of its activities in Iraq, supporting Shia groups there. And once again, I have to say, it sounded as though President Bush was building a case for some sort of military strike against Iran, certainly for more pressure, more tension. And this is the last thing, as Mona points out, that Lebanon needs now at a time when it is trying to bring down the level of violence. Bush seems to be stoking the flames here. That said, there was a kind of contradictory note. Robert Gates spoke yesterday and talked about building new bridges to Iran. So I'm not quite sure where the administration is in terms of its, is it recognizing that Iranian power has increased and it needs to engage, or is it preparing the case for war? I will leave that to you. I spoke to a Hezbollah official yesterday, and he said that he was hopeful that the crisis would be a catalyst for a political solution in the country. I think that is Hezbollah's hope, that the Arab League will get its act together and will broker some kind of solution to the deadlock over the president, over the formation of a new cabinet, and over a new electoral law for Lebanon, which he also mentioned. Clearly, I don't think Hezbollah wants this to deteriorate into an all-out civil war. As Mona pointed out, they've already crossed a red line by turning their guns on fellow Lebanese, and they understand that this is very harmful for the image that they would like to project. So, I mean, in a hopeful situation, the United States would support the Arab League in trying to mediate this quarrel and not try to exacerbate it further. Picking a fight that you cannot win, picking a fight that you are likely to lose, never helps. And yet, over and over, we see this pattern. We've seen it, I think, now with the senior government. We see it with the Bush administration as well. So I hope that cooler heads prevail. And I'll leave it there.
Well, thank you very much, Barbara. Emil, you have the floor.
Thank you. First, let me thank USIP for having me. I want to first go back to Mona's last point about whether Lebanon is sliding into civil war or not. It's not sliding into civil war, it's in the middle of one, and it is about time we recognize it for what it is. Usually we realize when a civil war started once we're in the middle of it. Right now, actually, the real debate should be about when it started, not whether it started. I don't want to be overly pessimistic. I'm hoping to get married in Lebanon in September, so I really don't want a civil war to happen. But you know, right now the right analogy is Lebanon is in 1973. Lebanon is at a place where the conditions for civil war, the reasons are being set, defined for every single group. And I'll talk about this a little bit more when I touch on the role of the army. But basically, what has happened in the past week has shown that sectarian groups need to arm themselves for self-defense, and this was a very detrimental aspect of the army's inaction during the fighting. This time, however, the fight is really a political struggle with sectarian overtones, not a sectarian war with political overtones. It has the potential to become a real sectarian war if Hezbollah loses all support in other communities, which I think is still unlikely right now, or if at some point you have Sunni extremists deciding to get involved in the battle. I mean, honestly, at this point, my biggest fear is some crazy jihadi coming down from the Niyeh or elsewhere and blowing himself up. That, I think, would be very detrimental. And to Hezbollah's credit, they understand this pretty well. Much of their propaganda or media campaign was directed at preventing this kind of escalation. I still think it's unlikely in the short term. And the third one is actually tensions within the Christian community. But this hasn't happened yet. I mean, the tensions have not escalated to a point where the Christians are likely to fight. We spent a lot of time focusing on the timing and the merits of the government decision, and this is very fair, especially that the government rescinded the two decisions yesterday night. I'm not going to try to spin that one. It is a political defeat for the government. It chose, it picked a fight that, as you said, it did not win. The government is still politically very relevant, and this is what we realized yesterday, today, and this is what Hezbollah itself realizes. But it's no longer capable of delivering. I mean, if you thought it was paralyzed before, wait to see what is going to happen the next step in the next phase. The government put its faith in the hands of the Lebanese armed forces, and to some extent, this has helped to soften the blow to the government itself. And if you look at what was said yesterday when the decision to rescind the two decisions was made, the announcement was made, basically the argument was the following. On one side, we don't want civil war. On the other, we want to give the Arab League a chance to get where it wants. And on the third hand, well, the army has asked us to do this, so, you know, who are we to actually be in the way of those who are ensuring stability right now? I fully agree with Mona when she said that the escalation was driven by local dynamics. I think there's one theory that we need to put to rest that somehow Washington called someone in the March 14 camp and asked for this kind of action. I think this is just as ridiculous as suggesting that Iran actually asked Hezbollah to kidnap the soldiers in 2006. Mm-hmm. I think it's very rooted in local dynamics, and the actors need to prove to their own constituencies that they can make decisions, that they can move forward, that they don't have to be necessarily constrained by the behavior of other actors. At the same time, what we saw is that it's mostly regional dynamics that can impose durable stability, or at least, you know, temporary one. I mean, let's see for how long this is going to last. This is very true. I mean, when you look at Saudi Arabia escalating the rhetoric a couple of days ago, and Iran, I mean, I'm sure the way Iran read it was that, okay, let's not push the envelope too far either. Let's constrain our own guy. I think this is the level where conflict management is happening at this point. Let me go back a week right now and do, and forgive me for this, but let me do some pop psychology here. Why was the decision to crack down on Hezbollah's infrastructure, communication infrastructure, and remove the head of security at the airport made? And why did Hezbollah actually react to this? I think we need to understand the psychological state in which all these actors are operating right now. The government is pretty much isolated, under siege. Some of them are being bumped off left and right. It's a pretty difficult state of mind for them. Same thing with Hassan Nasrallah, probably, and his security chief, who are somewhere protecting themselves in a bunker.
Yes.
Within the majority, there was increased frustration with Hezbollah, with the notion that the debate about the presidential elections was going nowhere. It was also for them a moment of political opportunity. I mean, there was a sense that the Honest movement was getting weaker. That there was some progress on the issue of the tribunal, and there was the upcoming report of the Terry Rudd Larson on 1559, that somehow there will be increased pressure on Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. It was also a moment of fear for the March 14 camp, and don't dismiss too quickly those concerns. There were suspicions that airport security was infiltrated, not just by Hezbollah, but also by Syria, and that the travel of March 14 leaders who can only leave the country through the airport was being monitored. Don't forget that two March 14 MPs were killed hours after coming back through the airport. I tend to think that Hezbollah is not involved in those things, but again, think of the state of mind of these actors. Hezbollah itself was also had a moment of fear. I mean, we saw major security weaknesses in recent months with Hezbollah. The Morni assassination is the most prominent one. But also look at the regional context. I mean, you know, Sadr in Iraq. I mean, you know, a government actually cracking down on the militia. I mean, the increasing pressure on Syria. You know, the dispatch of USS Cole. I mean, this feeling that, you know, the tribunal was actually moving. Hezbollah itself was not feeling very, very comfortable either. March 14 leaders visiting Washington, and never underestimate, the Lebanese capacity to think that some, you know, evil decision was made in Washington, a discussion between Jaja and Rice, or, you know, Abrams, he's the guy. Ultimately, however, for Hezbollah, the security concerns trumped all political calculations in the short term. It is important to understand that Hezbollah had indeed limited objectives when it mounted the coup. Probably the most annoying thing with Hezbollah is that it's one of the few groups in Lebanon that understand its weaknesses as much as its strengths. It didn't try to go for an all-out takeover of the government. I mean, operationally, they understand that they're a guerrilla force. They're not an occupation one. They also understand that politically being in Sunni neighborhoods is not going to help at all in terms of political legitimacy. They also understand that a limited takeover prevents Israeli retaliation or the identification of the Lebanese state with Hezbollah, which actually change mm-hmm. the terms of conflict with Israel. Hezbollah cannot actually fight on two fronts. I mean, it needs to calm one front to focus on the other one and then shift again. That said, we should not give Hezbollah too much credit. What it essentially did in the streets of Beirut was a campaign of political terror. I mean, it actually relied on its allies to commit acts of thuggery, brazen thuggery at some points. It attacked media outlets, it harassed journalists. I mean, up until today, people are getting phone calls. Non-Hezbollah Shias have been intimidated. But still, the military strategy was to defeat and retreat. It was not to hold and clear. And, this is very simple. Hezbollah doesn't seek territorial control. What it wants is this perception that it can come in any time, that it can impose the rule of the game on the ground. When it comes to the government, what we saw was weak leadership and deficient coordination in the early days of the fighting. It was very clear from the messages we got from the March 14 leaders, which varied in tone and substance. No one knew whether to escalate or to de-escalate in the first days. I think that to some extent shows that the government decision was mostly a symbolic one. I don't think that the government really had a implementation plan for dismantling all this. So it was mostly a symbolic victory that they were seeking. At the same time, what is even more troubling is that they had no coordination, prior coordination with the LAF command. They did not make their case to a number of people, which you'd think a government would do. However, let's understand that what Hezbollah did was pretty much a premeditated attack on the state. It was a coup. I mean, the objective, both the political objective there was to get the government to capitulate, in a humiliating and voluntary way. It's not about killing government leaders. It's about getting the current ones to admit that they were wrong and do it in a very disgraceful. What actually happened is that the March 14 leadership, after appearing very shaken in the first days, actually did a much better job when as events unfolded. As Hezbollah's limited objective became clear, there is one thing helped is that the March 14 media campaign also worked. I mean, for all of you who actually speak Arabic, just go on YouTube and watch the video of Sahar al-Khatib, who is this TV host on Future Television. It's 2.5 minutes, and I think this is the single most important piece of propaganda March 14 had. Of course, it's very emotional. It's not questioning her sincerity. But this has really impacted people's minds in the country in a way, political analysts sitting here would not understand. It was extremely powerful. The March 14 leaders understood that they, to some extent, they also needed to help each other. Samir Jarjar became the champion of the Sunnis, to some extent, offering, very warm words of support, saying we're not going to enter the fight, of course, but the Beirut of Saad Hariri is still standing. We still support it. There was a very interesting moment where all those leaders compensated for each other's inability to appear stronger or to actually jump in the fight. Politically, the shift in the balance, the shift in the military balance of power, does not necessarily mean a shift in the political balance of power. And this is extremely important to understand, that there is no sign of fragmentation within the Druze or Sunni components of March 14. To the contrary, they are outflanked to their right, not to their left right now. This is happening all over the board. Within the Christian camp, the game is still very unclear. And I think this is where, again, the opportunity exists for the balance to shift one way or the other. However, we cannot deny that all political lines in the country have moved. Hezbollah can no longer pretend that its weapons are only for external purposes, but has established a new kind of deterrence. Today, it can't prevent the majority, the government, to push the envelope as far as it did a week ago. And that's very true. At the same time, by losing the aura of resistance, Hezbollah is in a very difficult spot and has put its allies in a much more difficult spot. And this is where I see that this conflict between, you know, Hezbollah's military requirements and its political requirements. And it was very obvious during this past week. Let me end by making one quick note on U.S. policy. Mona has said that U.S. policy has been polarizing, and to some extent it's true. I don't think, however, that the U.S. is wrong to pick sides in Lebanon. You're not in a country where you're actually supporting 10% of the population. The country is pretty much divided in the middle. The question is whether you're actually inciting strife. And I see two major mistakes that the U.S. government made. The first one was the disgraceful management of the 2006 war. The other one is the bad management of the relationship with the majority, in the sense that instead of sticking to state-to-state relations, they have overreached and are, you know, the most obvious example I can give is meeting every March 14 leader who stops in Washington. It creates an impression in Beirut, a very negative one in Beirut. At the same time, those politicians really want it and think that they're relevant once they meet U.S. officials, which is pretty sad. But these are the two major mistakes I see. Mm-hmm. I don't think the U.S. picking sides is a problem. And we need to understand one final thing. What happened in March 2005 in the streets of Beirut is a unique instance of peaceful popular change in the Arab world in the past 50 years. People hate it when I introduce morality in foreign policy, but I think this is extremely important. Up until now, March 14, as a movement, as a leadership, has not used violence, is not in the business of using violence. And until that collapses, this governing principle of the coalition collapses, I don't think the U.S. should reverse its current policy of support.
Well, thank you very much, Emil. I think we can now turn it over to begin the question and answer session. And I would just like you to introduce yourself before posing the question. And if you'd like the question to go to a specific panelist, please do that as well. Yes.
Mike Lapis, a question for anybody. It appears that Hezbollah is the strongest force in the country, and that they're not going to give up their arms willingly unless they maybe are on the losing end of the civil war. Do any of you see a scenario where they could be integrated peacefully into the government, into the military?
Well, Hezbollah says that it would be willing to be part of the army under certain conditions. And it has longstanding conditions about the Israeli withdrawal from Shaba, the return of all Lebanese prisoners, and the end to Israeli overflights over the country. But Hezbollah officials have also said that much depends on a wider regional settlement. Several officials that I interviewed said that there had to be a resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli dispute that would determine the fate of 400,000 Palestinians in Lebanon before Hezbollah could give up its weapons. So obviously they're going to put off the date for a very long time and hold on to those weapons, since we've seen how powerful they are. Can I ask that people, by the way, go to the microphone to ask their questions so that they can? I see a gentleman here is trying to record, so I'll make it easier for him. Does anybody else want to?
Actually, the question right now is not really about Hezbollah's disarmament as much as, you know, the majority speaks about it. It's really about obtaining a certain degree of strategic certainty about Hezbollah's military behavior. And this is this is the kind of certainty that Hezbollah has not really offered. I mean, Hezbollah is an organization that started a war in 2006 and a civil war in 2008. So, you know, put yourself in the shoes of those trying to strike political alliances and deals. What constrains Hezbollah? Right now, let me give you an example. The Christian movement that is allied with Hezbollah, the Aounist movement, has signed a memorandum of understanding in 2006, supposedly to prevent civil strife and so on. Right now, the head of this movement, Michel Aoun, is making the argument that actually the MOU worked because Christian neighborhoods were not attacked. The response to that is, it doesn't matter. The dynamic has been launched. I mean, we are in a state of civil war right now. Whether it hit the neighborhoods yet or not is irrelevant, because we saw what happened in Iraq. We saw what happens elsewhere. Once a dynamic exists, you cannot remove yourself from that position. So, we can all speculate about what Hezbollah would look like the day it starts to disarm. I mean, a National Guard and, special forces within the military. I mean, we're all playing with it. Up until now, what we know is Hezbollah does not give... Hezbollah as an organization with a special status in the country has special responsibilities towards the rest of the population. And it hasn't met them. It has failed to meet those expectations on the part of much of the population. And this is where the real tension is. Mm-hmm. When the government talks about disarmament, it's really raising the bar to actually talk about defense strategy, military behavior.
Well, can I ask a question? What do you think Hezbollah should have done in response to the government's action?
I think Hezbollah had actually when I said limited objective, they were actually a little bit more ambitious than what is happening right now. I saw that Hezbollah, thanks will the fighting, could actually achieve the political objectives that it has been trying to achieve since 2006, mostly peacefully. I mean, get the government to accept the idea of a government in which it has a veto right. I mean, those kind of things. And it hasn't happened yet. And so I wouldn't call Hezbollah a victor in that sense. I mean, when Nasrallah made his speech, his political objectives were a lot more ambitious than what is happening on the ground today.
Well, the situation is still fluid,
and I wouldn't quite say
Lebanon is in a civil war. So I take issue with you on that. But it's a matter of semantics. But I do think that this conflict is at its core political, and so I think Barbara's question is important because it underscores the fact that mechanisms in Lebanon, institutional mechanisms, are weak to non-existent with respect to this what I put out there, which is the fact that Lebanon is in the midst of a renegotiation of the calculus of who has political power and to what degree. And so, to my mind, Hezbollah's arms, of course, they put them out there as playing the role of resistance, but it's also obvious that they're using them in other ways, as they have shown. And I don't think the question is going to be resolved until the underlying political issues that, to my mind, are driving this are dealt with.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
Yes, hi. My name is Faribors Frank Fouladi. I'm a Muslim, Persian native. I'm from Montgomery County, Maryland, next door to here. And an American patriot. I believe one of the ways we can defuse all of these conflicts and quote-unquote terrorism by providing opportunity for the people of the region can access food, shelter, healthcare, and education. I think Hezbollah, quote-unquote party of God, it is a good medium to do that. In order to bring them into mainstream, I was wondering that what is the recommendation of Mrs. Barbara Slavin, and I commend you for going to Iran for 6 times, that's good. And I was wondering what is your opinion you can bring them to mainstream. Thank you.
Thanks for the question. I invite you to read my upcoming report, which deals a lot with Hezbollah's social and cultural aspects. You know, if it were just a militia, just another Lebanese militia, it would not be in the position that it's in today. Obviously, it's become an extremely important provider of services. I'm told they have the best and least expensive private schools that are available to most Shia. They've got incredible health clinics and hospitals. I visited some of their institutions. They're rebuilding the southern suburbs of Beirut in a rather impressive way. You can say, I mean, it's not just because of Iran and Iranian money. It's because of their own expertise and because of the contributions they get from Lebanese Shia, primarily all across the world. They get a lot of support from people who are not particularly religious because they have shown that they have an ability to really serve their community and even the broader community. You know, until the airport was closed, I went to one hospital that, Hezbollah Hospital, and it's near the airport, and they told me a lot of people come and fly in, you know, specifically for special surgery there and then fly out again. So, you know, that's another aspect to this which we need to deal with, another reason why I don't think Hezbollah wants a civil war, a full-fledged civil war. They're still rebuilding after 2006. Their constituency was hurt very much by the Israeli bombing and all of the chaos at that time. So I think what we saw, Anil calls it a coup, but I think it was more a show of force than it was a coup. They want to intimidate people, obviously, but they don't want to have to go all the way. And so the effort should be made to find a way to help people pull back from the brink.
There's one major analytical mistake that many people make, which is to divorce the social services of Hezbollah from the larger ideological framework under which it operates. The social services are a pillar of a culture of mukawama, a culture of resistance, a society of resistance. They serve to legitimize what Hezbollah is doing on other fronts. I mean, of course, it's to some extent it's dawah, it's the you know, it's social calling of you know, any Islamist organization, what the normal Muslim organization should be doing. But never discount the role of those institutions in further radicalizing the community. It serves an inherently political role. It also serves the goal of Rod. I mean, exactly what Barbara said. Oh, we should think about the organization differently because it offers social services. Well, Hezbollah knows exactly that in Washington we're going to say this. Yeah. We're going to praise the thing. And to some extent, it creates some, you know, confusion about our own response. It's true. I mean, you know, go to Hezbollah and they will explain to you exactly that there is a unifying principle. The social services are part of a larger ideological construct.
Right, but if I could just add my two cents on this. I do think that it's not purely for cynical reasons of what will people say in Washington, and therefore we brought that. I do think the ideology, yes, in part it is a large part about the resistance, but it is also about an internal Lebanese narrative, about the place of the Shia in Lebanese society. And yes, the Shia have certainly progressed significantly from the days of the dispossessed, et cetera, et cetera. However, that said, their political power certainly is not commensurate with their demographic strength. And I also think that Hezbollah is filling a void that the government has not provided, a void in services that is not there by the government. And I think that's an equal part of the equation. So the two have to be, you have to have strong government institutions and the capacity to provide social services across the board. It's not there right now.
And Hezbollah needs to exist, needs also to empower the Shias outside institutions. I mean, we haven't really seen Hezbollah as a force for social and political reform within institutions to some extent because, yes, there are too many obstacles to this happening. At the same time, as long as Hezbollah can convince the Shias that it's their own well-being, their own empowerment lies outside institutions, Hezbollah will not be a reformist party. Hezbollah's social services will serve a larger political purpose. And again, I'm not disparaging this. I mean, as in Lebanon, where patronage is how you do politics, you know, this is a way to do it. I mean, everybody does it. You know, Hariri had his Hariri Foundation. The Christians had their own foundations over time. I mean, it's not, don't get me wrong. The problem is that in the other cases, the patronage network doesn't serve to shield, to also shield a military agenda, or resistance agenda.
Okay.
Can you devise a roadmap how to make it happen?
But we'll think that one later.
Yeah, I think what we'll do, why don't I, we could come, maybe hold that and come back to that later on.
Sure.
But since there is a line, I think there are four people already lined up, why don't I give the lady in black an opportunity.
Yes, my name is Amal Mudallali. I work for Mr. Hariri of Lebanon. I just want to take the point that Mona and Barbara spoke about the government's decision. I think people don't really know the extent of what happened before this decision was made. I think the government has been portrayed as somebody who is provoking Hezbollah, who is making miscalculations, making stupid decisions, and as if like Hezbollah is the state and the government is this militia that's really encroaching on the state's right to be a state and assert itself. There were many cabinet meetings that this decision was discussed. The issue of the camera and the network has been discovered more than a month ago. There was a security cabinet meeting that discussed it. There was negotiations with Hezbollah about it. And the decision by the government was made only after Hezbollah refused under any circumstance to deal with both issues in a constructive way. So to say that the government provoked Hezbollah to do this, it's really forgetting the last, and we talked about that, Mona, forgetting about what this is about the last 3 years that this government has been under siege. The prime minister cannot leave his sarai, that the parliamentarians are in prison, basically, in a hotel room. They've been hunted and killed. And now to say that because the government said, you cannot have this camera on the airport and the private in the VIP section to know who's coming in and out. And we know that every time you find somebody coming in and out, he's been gunned downtown Beirut. This is not fair. I think people have not to lose perspective. We have to know what these people are going through. And the Prime Minister said it rightly yesterday in the Financial Times. He said, yes, we miscalculated because we did not know that Hezbollah is going to use its weapons against its own people because they promised not to do that. Mm-hmm. So I really would like this to be clear because people in this town have short memories. And I think we can't forget what we've been going through for the last 3 years. The second issue is about the issue of what Hezbollah is doing, whether it's a civil war or not civil war. No, Hezbollah is not interested in civil war. Iran is not interested in civil war. They're interested in takeover. And Emil is right. It's a coup. Today, Naeem Qasim called it a surgical operation. They had a surgical operation to take over the government. And today they're asking about changing the Taif. This is about changing the system, political system in Lebanon. And I really would like to know from each one of you why you are not discussing the issues of Syria, the role Syria is playing. Because the pictures that were raised down in Beirut, in all the institutions that were taken, they were Bashar Assad's pictures and not Khomeini or Khamenei's pictures. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Mona, do you want to... Response.
Yeah, thank you, Amal. I certainly would not want to underestimate the level of pressure and the difficulties that the Lebanese government has experienced over the past 3 years. So that was certainly not my intention. I still believe it was a strategic miscalculation on their part to have undertaken those two decisions, which they have now rescinded. Again, with respect to the role of Syria, clearly, this Lebanon's crisis is situated within a broader regional context. There's no question about it. The question of those who raised Bashar al-Assad's picture and so forth, I mean, I will leave that to Emil to discuss as well. It's my sense, again, though, that was episodic, and I would not put that as, I don't think this was a coup by Hezbollah having been pushed by Syria to undertake it. I do not see it that way. I really maintain my line of analysis that what we're seeing in Lebanon, because of broken or non-existent institutions for negotiating the distribution of power, which was prompted, I would say, by the Syrian military withdrawal, as I said before, I really believe that we are witnessing not a coup by Hezbollah, and I would take issue with Emil's characterization of it as a coup. It was a dramatic flexing of muscle. Was it? Of course, no one is going to be in favor of violence. I think what Lebanon has suffered is horrendous. But I do think it underscores a deeper underlying political issue that must be resolved and that cannot be resolved without negotiation. And I would say, to that extent, it's important to engage with the Syrians in the broader regional context. But I don't see Syria by any stretch as being front and center in what happened over the last week, not by a long shot.
Just briefly, I agree with Mona's analysis. I think that, you know, obviously hindsight is always 20/20, but if you're going to make take actions like this against Hezbollah, you have to understand what the potential consequences could be. And it does show a certain lack of forethought and planning to take decisions like this and then just allow the consequences to develop as they have. But nobody is minimizing the pressure and the terrible situation that the Senyera government has been in over the last 3 years.
I'm going to disagree with Mona another time, and it's not about the issue of coup. I don't think Hezbollah is after political power. I think what Hezbollah wants is to have a dominant say in security, defense, and foreign policy. This is what Hezbollah has been very uncomfortable with. Hezbollah doesn't seek to advance Shia grievances. I mean, it's about, they will advocate them as long as it doesn't complicate the conduct of Mukawama. And when I say Mukawama, I'm not talking about precise resistance acts. I'm talking about a process of mobilization, of radicalization of its own street. But Hezbollah, since 2005, the real change, Mona, I don't think is one of, you know, balance of power between the sectarian groups. It's Hezbollah not having a measure itself. I mean, the way I'm talking about the degree of certainty about that the government camp wants about Hezbollah's misbehavior, Hezbollah itself has no degree of certainty about, you know, its foreign defense policy and so on. I think this is, so Hezbollah would be very happy to bring back Saad Hariri and have him play the role that Rafiq Hariri was playing in Lebanon in the 90s when the Syrian war around, where there was a clear division of power. Mm-hmm. You, Mr. Hariri, you deal with economic issues, you go around, you raise funds, and you have your say. When it comes to the real strategic matters, it was the Syrians calling the shots back then. Hezbollah right now wants to know that it can call the shots. It doesn't want to be constrained in the conduct of resistance. Again, I wish Hezbollah were after political power in a sense, because, you know, we would be talking about the real issues in the country, political reform, social reform, I mean, you know, name them, education, what the hell. We are not at that point because Hezbollah is not interested in institutionalized political power.
I don't think the government is either. I think Lebanon is caught in a feudal system. Again, I think we need to underscore, though, that the Syrians are no longer calling the shots in Lebanon, not nearly to the degree that they were. So I think this is a major change. And I also think, and I'm by no means an expert on Hezbollah, and I'm just putting it as a question. My understanding is that Hezbollah itself is in the throes of a question as to what its role is and whether or not it evolves toward what you've described, or whether it retains and maintains and puts as superior its role as a resistance force. To my mind, it's an open question, and it's a debate that's taking place within the organization. And I actually think that this what happened is very much exemplary of that very debate that's going on.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Joyce Karam with Al Hayat newspaper. Emil, my question is to you. I just wanted to ask you about the pro-Syrian groups that were engaged in what we saw the last week, mainly the SSNP, the Ba'athist, and others who are, as we all know, much less disciplined than Hezbollah. I mean, what does that tell about Syria's intentions in this? They waited 24 hours after Hezbollah went to the streets to engage in this. Does this tell about maybe a difference between Syria and Iran in dealing with Lebanon? What does Syria really want from this situation? And given how undisciplined these groups are, some say they're after many of the assassinations, how things are going to go from here?
I think the involvement of those groups in in the fighting, and especially in what I call psychological terror operations, cannot be underestimated. We spent a lot of time focusing on Hezbollah. Those groups themselves have had an important role, and mostly political, not really in the fighting. Of course, they're less disciplined. I mean, I think Hezbollah is probably the most disciplined armed force in the world at this point. First, you know, the fact that Hezbollah accepted that those groups operate side by side with Hezbollah is very troubling. And for me, it suggests one thing. Hezbollah wanted some psychological terror. I mean, if you look at Al-Manar, the campaign on Al-Manar, it was very telling. I mean, the kind of rumors that were flying left and right were unbelievable. So that's one element of this terror campaign. The second one is actually these groups. I mean, they are the one who burn down buildings. Well, guess what? They get one block away from Future Television, then Hezbollah stops, and then you have those groups getting out, going and burning the building. It gives Hezbollah a sliver of deniability in the sense that it's not us, it's them. Everybody knows they're undisciplined. Yes, true. At the same time, you could have prevented this from happening. So I think, you know, Hezbollah has some deniability, but I won't give Hezbollah free ride on this. It also shows Syria's leverage. I mean, those are the guys who replaced the Sa'd-Hariri pictures with Bashar al-Assad pictures. And it actually shows that Syria has a number of tools in Lebanon. I think Hezbollah is not necessarily Hezbollah is a Syrian tool, instrument. I think Hezbollah has its own calculations. It, you know, can disagree with Syria. It does disagree with Syria on a number of issues. But Syrian leverage goes essentially through these groups who had and have strong ties to Syrian intelligence and have no social base. I mean, we're talking about patronage. Those guys are not into patronage. They don't have money. I mean, they really rely on Hezbollah and others to actually prop them in the regions. They wouldn't win a single seat if they were to run for parliament. But, I mean, this is where Syria's role is pretty... what is the level of coordination between these groups and Syria? I have no answer there. I can only speculate that Syria was actually pretty happy to see them on the ground. And to some extent, having pictures of Bashar in Beirut again, it's good for Bashar's own ego.
Could I just say one point on this? I do think I would agree with what Emil has said. I do think of the various external players or internal players, the one that potentially has an interest in civil war in Lebanon is Syria. And so, in some way, I mean, I think that it's completely consonant with Emil's line of analysis. And for many reasons, obviously the fear, the concern that the Syrians would capitalize on chaos in Lebanon as an excuse to come back in militarily. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that the international community will allow it. But it's certainly out there as a possibility. Although that said, it was raised in a meeting we had the other day that there is also reason for the Syrians not to want to see a civil war in Lebanon, the Syrians themselves being a minority Alawi regime in a largely Sunni country, and the extent to which these sectarian tensions that may be elevated in Lebanon could then spill over to the detriment of the Syrian regime in Damascus. So, complicated picture.
Thank you.
My name is Dale Dean. I'm a retired Foreign Service officer, and granted that institutions in Lebanon are very weak, as the panel has said, what role do you see for the Lebanese armed forces in the wake of last week's violence? Press reports indicate that the army pretty much stayed neutral. I was wondering if this should be their role. Maybe there is something else they can do if we move toward a dialogue, which you've suggested is necessary for a political resolution. Thank you very much.
Let me give you an example of what the army didn't do. People in West Beirut actually called the army when they were stuck in the middle of the fighting. They weren't players. And basically you had officers saying, oh, we're not entering this neighborhood. We can't, you know, this is not something we can do. And believe me, this is going to have a huge impact on the psychology of security in Lebanon, how people think about their own security needs. So to say the army was neutral is, I don't really buy this. I think the commander in chief of the army looked at the balance of power, realized that militarily Hezbollah had the upper hand. Putting up a fight was impossible. At the same time, the army didn't have to go to the extent of actually taking over positions that Hezbollah had secured, so Hezbollah fighters could go and take over another position, which happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, in some places, the army acted as a surrogate. Again, it provides stability. I mean, this is what you want. You want, you know, army Lebanese soldiers manning those positions. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think it's a very sensitive situation to be in. The army stayed neutral, but within the army, the discussion was very heated. I mean, you know, there are credible reports of major dissent at senior levels of the LAF about inaction. And I think the army didn't have to be involved in the fight. I mean, it just needed to show the citizens that, you know, we'll care for your personal safety in key moments. My concern is that those reports about citizens not being rescued are going to be propagated and are going to sound worse than they actually are, because there weren't that many civilian casualties, right, after all. I mean, you know, the number of civilian casualties was very small.
Okay.
But in terms of propaganda, it's been used a lot.
If I could add, I hadn't heard about the reports of civilians being stranded and so forth. Obviously, that's very concerning. I do think the army, to be fair, was in a bind. The fact of the matter is that beyond what you've said, if they intervened and turned their arms against Hezbollah, it being largely a number of Shia in the army itself, the concern was that this would potentially lead to a break in cohesion within the army, which would be a significant step towards civil war. So I do think one has to call the army a surrogate for Hezbollah, I think, again, is a little bit, I'm not sure I'd agree with that characterization. I think they were in a very difficult position. Our government continues to put much of our faith and funding in the Lebanese army. And it has been considered over the past several years as the strongest, most sort of unbiased institution in Lebanon. And many people are placing their hope in the army to serve as an arbiter and a mediator in a very, very difficult situation.
The army will be a central part of any new solution. However, one of the big problems, it has lost the aura it had gained really during the Nahal Barid events. I mean, this is the thing.
The Islamic fundamentalists they defeated in Nahal Barid are not Hezbollah.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Again, unreasonable to expect them to be able to stand up in that way.
Mostly not Lebanese.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question.
My name is Jean-Paul Chami. I'm from Lebanon. I'm a visiting fellow here at USIP. And I have two questions and a short story. The story is about a Shiite mother in the south of Lebanon. Right after the war in 2006, when the Lebanese army was dispatched, she said that she is welcoming the army. It's nice to have the Lebanese army, on one condition, that this army would, you know, give the people in the south the same sense of security that Hezbollah is giving. And by security, I think she meant as well economic, social, education, jobs, you name it. I think the status of Hezbollah is really intriguing, because they have created, I think, a new phenomenon. I think we are witnessing a nation within a state. And I think dealing with this issue is, you know, way more complicated than dealing with one clearly defined political actor or even militarized party in a country like Lebanon. My two questions are basically, what kind of negotiations do you expect to happen under gunpoint and under a gun that is still, you know, smoking, a gun that has been fired? So I'm only imagining here one definition of the word diplomacy that was once used, which is, it's just a way to keep telling a dog, you know, good doggy, until you find a stone. So I'm just hoping this is not another postponing of, you know, clashes until parties start arming again. And the fact that the Lebanese army didn't intervene, I think that was maybe a wise decision, but I think whether it intervened or not, I think the outcome would have been actually the same. I think by not intervening, this has led to mistrusting the army, and I think the natural reaction of at least the Christian neighborhoods is to start training and arming again, the same thing that happened in 75, you know, and on. Thank you.
Let me just, to your anecdote, I'll respond with an anecdote. I was interviewing one of the Hezbollah officials in March, and he said, we won't get a president until you get a new president. And I think we really, you know, to a great extent, Lebanon has always been hostage to the regional situation, but you really feel it now even more. This tremendous polarization that's taken place between Iran and Syria's, you know, allies and the allies of the United States is making a solution much, much more difficult. And it's hard to see that U.S. policy is going to change except to make things worse. I mean, judging from the kind of bellicose rhetoric, at least, that we're hearing from President Bush, it's very hard to see the U.S. taking any other kind of position in this while he's still the president. So I think we have to, the question is, can Lebanon, you know, somehow limp along until next January without an explosion of violence? Another anecdote I'll tell you, I was on my way from Tehran to Lebanon. I went via Qatar, and arriving in Beirut, I was next to a Lebanese Christian guy who had been working for U.S. forces in Baghdad. He'd been one of the security guards in Baghdad. And he was bragging about how he was going home, this big muscular guy, going home to work with his militia. So I think that is the other issue, whether the Christians will get involved, whether they'll fracture, because clearly they have been rearming in a massive way. And I would be more afraid of the militia of someone like Jaja, perhaps, than some of these other groups.
Just to take issue with what Barbara just said about rearmament. I mean, what we've seen is that every group rearmed. What we have not seen is this kind, what has been described for the past 2 years as, you know, I mean, just go on the internet, read what Cy Hirsch has been writing and Nir Rosen, and I mean, this massive retraining, reorganization, you know, coming up of doctrine of all these militia, it hasn't happened. What has happened is rearmament of mostly overweight people or kids who are not trained to do this. I mean, we haven't seen this massive, you know, organization of militias, and this worries me a lot because, I mean, I'm not going to deny that the price of AK-47 in Beirut has rocketed.
Yep.
I mean, people are buying personal weapons, and people are also fooling themselves into thinking that, you know, you buy 10 of them and, you know, you practice once in some forest and there you are. We haven't seen a comprehensive retraining program by anyone else, including Jaja. I mean, you know, this is a typical name that you want to bring up. He scares people, right? You know, he's as bad as the others. I mean, every one of them, even Hassan Nasrallah, was a military commander and fought. I mean, they're all nasty. They're all unsavory to some extent.
Right.
This is what they did. The question up until now is, which political leadership made a decision to use violence? Because March 14 guys, people, also used violence. I mean, I'm not going to say that they never shot someone. They did shot someone. But at what, who, which political leadership made a conscious, deliberate decision to use violence since 2005? It was Hezbollah a week ago.
Right.
No
right.
one else.
Right.
In terms of negotiations under gunpoint, I mean, you know, we're not, the government can say, or the majority can say a lot right now, you know, about how, you know, they will only talk once Hezbollah disarms. It's not going to happen. I mean, this is a kind of precondition that, you know, is never going to be met. To some extent, they shouldn't. The majority camp should not overplay its hand right now. I mean, it should be happy that politically it's still standing, and maybe doing fine later. I haven't written them off at all. But they should not overplay their hand in this new phase where they will actually say, "We'll only talk about issues if, I mean, you know, short-term conflict de-escalation mechanism." Just because Hezbollah has not provided assurance on the weapons. Because we understood that Hezbollah's military objectives are by nature limited. they have to integrate this in all their discussions. They cannot push the envelope as far as they did before.
If I could just also very briefly weigh in on this. First of all, I think it's important in trying to analytically understand what it is that drove Hezbollah. By no means are my comments meant to in any way condone the use of force. So, as I said, I believe that a Rubicon was crossed. I believe a major red line was crossed by Hezbollah. And your description of the smoking gun on the negotiation table is very well taken. Unfortunately, it is the situation that Lebanon finds itself in today. Many of us who have been watching Lebanon have been increasingly concerned about a political impasse that has been left to fester for the last 18 months, and we're concerned precisely about this. I have a paper out on the table which makes that point, that the longer the political impasse goes unresolved, the greater the propensity for violence. Unfortunately, Lebanon has crossed that line. To my mind, again, the answer is we are, you know, the fact that there's, I know your point, Emil, is not the fact that there's no training going on makes it really scary, i.e. they should be trained and therefore we'll have trained militias.
No. I
understand, but I want to, and unfortunately, I do think when I was there, someone was teasing me, I'm Armenian from Lebanon on one side of my family, and someone was teasing me and saying that his Armenian pal had invited him over to his apartment so he could show him his terrific arsenal. I don't know how fat he was, but he was not trained. His terrific arsenal of guns. And he was saying, oh, you wouldn't believe he had this, he had that, he had this, he had that. And the guy said, well, why do you have all these? I mean, are you planning to use them? He said, no, this is Lebanon. This is Beirut. It's a culture. He was sort of putting it out as a status symbol. You don't need a Ferrari. You've got a, whatever it is, Glock or whatever those things. I don't know what it's called. Anyway, the point is, I do think it's a unfortunately a culture at this point that has this sort of militaristic, violent undercurrent to it. Again, the challenge for those in Lebanon, outside of Lebanon, is to help the Lebanese to de-escalate and to move toward the only thing that can bring lasting peace and stability, a political solution.
Mm-hmm. Right. And looking at the lineup, I think this must be the last question, I think. Yeah.
Hi, Maran Benai at the Middle East Bulletin. Thank you for a very spirited debate or discussion. I want to push a little bit on negotiations on the question of the Arab League. And, you know, it's been one of the only forces that's been very actively pushing some sort of negotiation. At the same time, as we saw at the Damascus summit, it represents very much the split within the region. And so do you see any prospects for progress with regards to the Arab League and its efforts?
The Arab League delegation was supposed to give a press conference. This is why I was a few minutes late. I was just waiting for them to say something that, you know, in order to prevent me saying something very wrong later on. So we don't know. We know that a deal was made. I mean, we know that the government didn't rescind the decision unilaterally. It was part of a bigger picture. And the Arab delegation came in. If you look at what happened in recent days, you had the Friends of Lebanon statement that the U.S. wanted a little bit tougher than it actually was. And the reasoning for toning it down was that you need to create some room for the Arab delegation to go to Beirut and reach some kind of, you know, deal, short-term deal. The delegation was headed by Qatar, which to some extent is unfortunate, but at the same time, it did well by Arab League standards, I have to say.
The bar is very high, though.
Yeah, I know. So, how many enemies did I make today? So, it did well by Arab League standards, and not just this, because, you know, the parties themselves were all willing to compromise at this point. I mean, I think there was no appetite for more escalation. You know, March 14th, don't forget that to some extent, the government camp was happy with the small beating Hezbollah got in the Shuf. It was a beating, right? So they can say, you know, militarily, we could sustain a fight for, you know, a day. I don't think it was tenable for longer. But yeah, they got their little thing. Symbolically, they can calm their guys and say, well, it's not completely. Although, militarily, there's no doubt Hezbollah won. I mean, then again, don't get me wrong on this. So the conditions were there, I think, for the Arab League to play a positive role. Now, the substance of the deal, well, it looks very much like the deal that was on the table a week ago. I mean, it's still first president, second cabinet, and third electoral law. Not much has changed. And my question is, what has changed really in terms of the calculations of the parties to move forward?
Can I jump in on that?
And here is where Michel Slimane has actually a bigger shot than before for becoming president. And this is the opportunity I see.
Right, but I do say, I think Emil's point is well taken. The deal wasn't on the table a week ago. It's been on the table for months.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
and the Arab League has attempted time and again to mediate this crisis with no success. But what has changed? The last week is what's changed. Mm. The fact that the Lebanese themselves are looking over the abyss, and so is the, I think so are those in the region with understandable concern. Can the Arab League sort of play the role of sort of facilitators, how I would put it? You know, I think it's a big question. Personally, unfortunately, I'm not too optimistic given their poor track record. But again, given the dramatic turn of events in Lebanon, hopefully everyone will come to their senses and they will be able to figure out some kind of lasting political settlement. Otherwise, I fear we are headed towards civil war.
Well, I think that was the last question. So, I would like to thank Mona and Barbara and Emil for really superb presentations. And, of course, for the vigorous question and answer period. I think one of the touchstones of a successful panel is if you can generate some disagreement and differences and not have consensus on some issues. And I think there are three where there were clear differences. We had no consensus on whether Lebanon is in a civil war or not. I think also there were some differences as to how you characterize Hezbollah's recent action. Is it a coup d'etat or it isn't a coup d'etat? And I think a third difference, essential difference, was on the impact of the posture of the army during the recent events and what this might mean for the long-term role of the army in the Lebanon. But having said that, I think a useful panel also gives some sense and guidance as to the way forward. And I think all the three panelists are agreed on three fundamental areas. And the first is that the current conflict is largely driven by local and internal dynamics. And I think that was an important point. The second is that the conflict is essentially a political one. It's a political struggle, as I think Emil put it, with sectarian overtones, not a sectarian struggle with political overtones. It's essentially a political struggle. And if it's essentially a political struggle, then only a political solution can bring lasting peace to the volatile situation in the Lebanon. And I think the third important point that came out was that at least for policymakers need to understand that there are critical differences between Hezbollah, Hamas, and Al-Qaeda. And if you're going to conflate the three groups, it's going to be counterproductive and you're not going to have an effective policy and not going to be able to engage in any useful manner in Lebanon or in the wider region. And so let me thank the panelists, and I also thank you for at least prompting them to have this very vigorous debate. Thanks.
No hard feelings.
No, 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 no.